This past Tuesday, I received a number of email alerts calling my attention to a discovery of signal importance in the world of biblical scholarship. Karen King, a professor at Harvard Divinity School, shared news of a 4th century papyrus that seems to contain a reference by Jesus to my wife. Further, the text appears to have him say, "She will be able to be my disciple." And to top it all off, we learn the text refers to Mary in a way that indicates she would be, well, Mrs. Jesus. So, there we have it. Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married. And while the text doesn't say it, maybe the Da Vinci Code had it right. Maybe Jesus and Mary made their way to Europe, where they started a family that would culminate in the Merovingian dynasty that ruled France for 300 years in the early Middle Ages, until they were deposed by the Carolingians with the blessing of none other than the Pope, the supposed vicar of Christ. Dan Brown fans, step forward and rejoice. Say, "I told you so." The canonical gospels have it all wrong. The church has missed the plot. Now is your moment. Well, maybe it's not quite your moment. There's the small problem that all of this comes not from a full-fledged, full-length gospel, even if that's the term that's been bandied about in the press, but a small fragment whose provenance is unknown, actual age has yet to be confirmed, and authenticity is being questioned by some scholars of Coptic church history and linguistics. Further, as Father James Martin noted in a piece that ran in the New York Times the day after the news broke, it is rather strange that none of the gospels speak of Jesus' wife, especially when it would seem right and appropriate for them to do so. Consider, if the authors of the four gospels saw fit to mention his siblings and mother, why not make reference to Jesus' wife? The answer is obvious. Clearly, Jesus was not married. Traditionalists, come forward. Declare your vindication. Your time has come. Well, maybe it hasn't come quite yet. You see, while the preponderance of evidence and tradition weigh heavily on the unmarried Jesus side of the scales, we cannot offer an unassailable, definitive, 100% ironclad, sure declaration that Jesus was single. For the simple fact is, we don't know. And if we are to be honest, we must admit that whether Jesus was single or married is just one of many things we don't know about him. We don't know whether he was short or tall, thin or fat, whether he had a strong or weak chin, a snub nose, or one that was long and straight. We don't know if his voice was high-pitched or deep, nor do we know the color of his hair or his eyes, though it's a fair bet that centuries of glorious, transcendent Western European art, some of it intimately familiar to many of us here, have got it wrong. And given all of the arguing about the place of gays and lesbians in the wider church today, we might take a moment to consider that we don't actually know anything about Jesus' sexual orientation. Jesus could have been athletically gifted. He could have had an awful singing voice. We just don't know. The Gospels address none of these subjects. And even when they do comment on things, they don't always agree. Did you pay attention to those birth narratives that Ken read a few moments ago? I chose those readings this morning in the hope that you would notice the difference between the two accounts. To begin with, Luke has a census and a manger, not Matthew. And if you go further into the surrounding verses, you'll see other variations, like two quite different genealogies, not to mention the shepherds in Luke and the magi in Matthew. But the birth narratives of Luke and Matthew read like identical texts when compared with that between those two gospels and Mark and John. Look at Mark and you'll find nothing about Jesus' birth. And John, well, he listens to his own muse and offers a mystical, almost cosmic take on Jesus' origins. And what of other writers? Paul, writing about Jesus just 20 or so years after the crucifixion, has nothing to say about Jesus' nativity nor any of the other topics we've discussed. And the few non-Christian ancient sources about Christ and early Christianity, like Tacitus, Pliny the Younger, and Josephus, are silent too. There's really so much about Jesus we don't know. That was a point made repeatedly and forcefully by one of my divinity school professors, a renowned scholar of the historical Jesus, and I should note, a faithful lay leader of his local Lutheran church. We really know very, very little about Jesus, we were told. In one sense, as we've noted already, this is true. Yet consider what we do know about Jesus. For starters, there's his name. Now, this may not seem like much, but consider just how few individuals we can even identify from the early decades of the first century. Jesus wasn't a king or general or high-ranking official. He wasn't a famous sculptor or poet. Yet of the estimated 200 to 300 million people alive at that time, the vast majority of whom remain unknown and anonymous to us, Jesus is one of the few we can name. And not only name, we also know that he was an innovative religious figure of consequence, that he caught the attention of the authorities in such a way that he soon entered the historical record, that what he taught and did quickly compelled the attention, loyalty, and devotion of a diverse group of people across a sprawling empire. Still, for the sake of discussion, let's proceed from the proposition that we really know very, very little about Jesus. This still begs the question, so what? So what if we don't know much about Jesus, the historical person? Does it matter? Think about it. If we are Orthodox, Trinitarian Christians, we make some claims about Jesus, including this. He was fully human and fully divine. The first part of that assertion means Jesus lived and Jesus died. That he walked the earth just as you and I do today. Jesus, we believe, we know, was real as Augustus Caesar, as Clara Barton, as Abraham Lincoln, as Lady Gaga, as real as Karl or Groucho Marx. We just don't know if he was married. And it really doesn't matter. If this is the case, though, why raise the issue? Why spend time talking about Jesus' marital status? Because my hope and my prayer is that over the last few minutes, I may have encouraged you to step back from your familiar preconceptions about who Jesus was, so that you might gain new perspective and insights into who he is. That thinking about Jesus then, we will be prepared to engage with Jesus now. I can't even begin to imagine what it might have been like to be one of the people in one of those crowds who gathered around Jesus to hear him preach. Let alone fathom what it was to be one of the disciples who lived and traveled with him on a daily basis. What an experience. What a blessing. Yet you and I enjoy an experience and a blessing that was not available to those who knew, encountered, met, or saw Jesus. We come to him without distractions. We don't find ourselves focusing on the way he combs his hair, what his accent says about his background, the cut of his clothes, or whether we find his friends or his wife to be an asset or a liability. We don't judge him by whether he seems nice, whether we want to look at him on the TV for the next 4 years, or whether we want to sit down and enjoy a beer with him. We don't have that option. All we can do is look back to the man of Galilee who preached the word of God to all who would listen, taught anyone willing to know what it was God called them to do, healed those who were ill regardless of their station in life, and who articulated a radically fresh vision of the kingdom of heaven rooted in the ancient tradition of Israel. When we do this, if we do it with open eyes, open hearts, and open minds, we should be shocked. For the Jesus we will meet will be one who comforts us, yet challenges us, who draws us in, yet puts us on our guard, who is reassuringly familiar, yet utterly strange. This past summer, while we were in London, Rachel and I went to St. Martin in the Fields in Trafalgar Square for a concert. Now, a bit of background is in order here. I have some history with St. Martin's, or perhaps I should rephrase that. I have some powerful memories of the place. In years past, I have worshipped there, indeed may have taken the most meaningful communion of my life there. Early in the morning on a mid-spring day in a side chapel with a priest and two homeless people who clearly had been enjoying too much to drink. But there, I'd experienced fully the presence of God. And I've enjoyed music there, including a performance of Beethoven's 4th piano concerto that still stirs me more than a decade later. This, you see, is a place that has made an impression on me. And so I will confess to being stunned when we entered the sanctuary one evening this past August, and I took in the east window above the altar. It had been changed since I was last in London. And I mean changed. Yes, I knew there was a renewal plan for the church and its campus, and I will say that the building and new spaces were looking grand and fit to purpose, befitting a place that is active house of worship, vibrant center of cultural life, and vital provider of services to those in need. But the window! My God, I thought! What were they thinking? Here, at the visual center of James Gibbs's beautiful Baroque church, whose design was rooted in the classical vernacular, an expression of order, of balance, of straight lines and grids and perfect proportions and forms, was this new window. The new design still employed the familiar window pane grid, but with a critical difference. In the middle was an off-centered oval, softly illuminated, no less, one that not only interrupted the grid, but distorted it. My initial reaction was one of visceral loathing. But short of leaving before the concert began, or sitting there with my eyes closed for the better part of 2 hours, I had no choice but to look at that window. And as the music of Corelli and Vivaldi filled the sanctuary, something happened. I looked at the window and contemplated what I saw, and I knew then I had been touched by God's grace. You see, that evening, this remarkable window, designed by Shiraza Hushari, had made visible what Jesus and the cross mean to me. Here, in the heart of an 18th century church designed by a Catholic Englishman, was a 21st century window created by an Iranian-born woman. A window that represented how Jesus draws us into his heart, but in doing so, changes us and all around us. Here, I saw how Jesus takes all of our neatly ordered assumptions, and if we allow him, disrupts them and us. Here, I saw how Jesus, when he is at the center of our attention, is able, again, if we are willing, to transform us. It was with great joy and excitement that I found myself before the altar, beneath that window, taking communion the following two Sundays. It was with excitement that I carried this experience back to the Upper Valley, inspired to join with you on a journey these next few weeks as we explore Jesus in worship and the forum and adult ed and Sunday school, all in the hope and with the prayer that when we are done, we will be in a place where we as individuals and as a community are enabled to begin to see and know Jesus in new and transforming ways. Which brings us back to Mrs. Jesus. Did she exist? Probably not, but we'll never know. Does it matter? Not a whit. For whether Jesus was married or single, short or tall, thin or fat, handsome or ugly, straight or gay, he was still Emmanuel, God with us, the incarnation of our Creator's love, come among us, bearing grace unbounded, hope restored, and the promise of life made new.